died and was then replaced by the by Pope Pius XII. Of course, we went right along with the program. And it, right. And it's O'Brien's, excuse me, it's O'Brien's feeling that, if that situation had worked a different way because of the Protestant pressure on Hitler to stop the euthanasia business, that there might have been a chance. Because that encyclical apparently spoke very strongly toward this whole issue of the German state and the all that other stuff that had duped a lot of other people. Anyway, it's a good article. Well, I guess we're here, all of us who are going to be here. That's fine. This is a topic that it's kind of hard for a lot of Christians and especially Lutherans to deal with, considering our not very good history and relationship to it. I use the title of Anti-Semitism, How That Affects the Way We Speak of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and of course it affects it to a great deal. I think basically it affects it because we speak to this issue looking at the history of the Holocaust, looking at the real bankruptcy of the Christian Church and the role, especially that the Lutheran Church played in that. And it's a difficult thing for us to face. I mean, it would seem at a point in history where it was most critical that the Church stand on the right side of an issue. Unfortunately, far too many people were standing, and the Lutherans were standing on the wrong side of the issue. And I think for that reason, we really haven't wanted to look too closely at a period of our history that is difficult for us to accept. But I think in order that we may be able to make a differentiation between anti-Semitic behavior or anti-Semitic statements and the difference between that and what I would call the legitimate critique of Israel's policies, meaning the way the state of Israel is acting today, especially dealing with the Palestinian population in the West Bank, I think we should have some background so we're be able to make that differentiation. Because in far too many cases, I think our fear of being labeled anti-Semitic has kept us from speaking on this issue. And it's understandable. I mean, I suffer the same fear. I think to anyone who has any sympathy or empathy for what happened to the Jewish community in the Second World War and certainly in the Holocaust, the worst thing that can happen to you is to be called anti-Semitic. And I am sure that there have been times during some of my presentations just about 2 months ago, I was asked to come to Luther Seminary and speak on the day of Christian-Jewish dialogue. I was to be the Christian speaker, and Rabbi Stephen Pinsky from Temple Israel, largest synagogue in Minneapolis, St. Paul, was to be the other speaker. Well, luckily for us, no, I don't know, luckily, but anyway, it turned out that we said most the same things about this issue. But it's always a fear that that your remarks on this issue are going to be interpreted as anti-Semitic. So, anyway, let's take a look at anti-Semitism. I must tell you that I have used a lot of the ideas have come from a wonderful book that I would suggest everyone read who's interested in the history of the State of Israel. It's a book called The Siege, which was written 3 or 4 years ago by an Irish historian who used to be in the United Nations, Conor Cruz O'Brien. And it's excellent, and I have borrowed heavily from that for this presentation. Doing the research, I thought that I had known quite a bit about this issue. After all, I'd read The Diary of Anne Frank when I was 12 years old and all the rest of that stuff. But I was really amazed as I got into it to see how in a sense, very simplistically speaking, one thing led to another. But that's history, one thing leading to another. And there were a number of points along the way of this movement or this this movement toward genocide where things could have been stopped, where if one thing had happened or another thing had not happened, perhaps all of these millions of people would not have died. But it is almost diabolical. When a certain development was necessary, let's say a certain philosophy or a certain ideology or a certain convergence of some specific historical events, when that was needed to be added to the mix, so to speak, it was there. It's almost, as I said, it's a kind of a diabolical building of one event upon the other event that eventually led, of course, to genocide. I've put something up on the board here so we can maybe try to be a little easier to follow the discussion. Basically, I'm dividing this discussion into two basic aspects of anti-Semitism. One is the traditional Christian anti-Semitism that most of us are quite well acquainted with. We all know that. That's the whole issue of the Christ killers, etc. Jews killed Jesus. Let their sins be on our head, on the heads of our children, etc., etc. And I'll talk about how that had a built-in limit to it. The second form is the nationalist racist form of anti-Semitism, which I hope to show through this discussion, was much more dangerous. Certainly the elements of both mixed together, but in the end, the nationalist racist, which had no limit to it, which eventually opened the way to genocide, wiped out the Christian limit, basically because the Christian church and everything was co-opted into the nationalist racist ideology. And that, of course, is the real black mark for the church, that it was co-opted that way. There were really two types of anti-Semitism, one you could call Western, one you call Eastern. The Eastern variety was that kind of anti-Semitism that you would find in the Soviet Union or Russia. And it was basically an upper-class phenomenon in the sense that the Jews were hated because they were the carriers of liberal ideas. They were the carriers of the ideas of the Enlightenment, which, of course, were a threat both to the structure of the Orthodox Church and the structure of the Tsarist regime. And in that sense, those ideas and the Jews were seen as a threat to the upper class, the establishment, so to speak. Not that the establishment didn't use the lower classes to carry out the pogroms, etc., but basically it was the ideas of the driving force behind the anti-Semitic ideas came philosophically and ideologically from that those areas. They could be manipulated, the peasants could be manipulated, but still it was an upper class phenomenon basically. In Western Europe, the situation was different in the sense that here it was more of a middle class phenomenon, and as such potentially more dangerous because it was an ideology that was shared by many, many more people and people that really were across the spectrum of civilization. It too certainly the anti-Semitism in Western Europe was a consequence of liberal ideas, but those liberal ideas had eventually meant that the Jews became liberated, in a sense, assimilated in Western Europe to an extent that they had never known before. the ideas of democracy, et cetera, had really catapulted the Jews right into the middle class life in Western Europe. And by 1871, the Jews were almost totally emancipated. They were playing a very important role in middle class urban life in the areas of business, finance, journalism. It seemed as though it was never a better time to be a Jew in Europe than at that time. But back to the idea of Christian anti-Semitism. There was in the European anti-Semitism, as I said before, the Christian tradition of the Christ killers, etc. But there was also a nationalist resentment. There are always these two things together: the Jew as Christ killer, but the Jew also as alien, not belonging to the national group. It's also the time, of course, of the rise of nationalism, where your identity stopped being associated necessarily with God or with the church or whatever, but your identity then came via your citizenship in a country, whether you were French or German or whatever. And I'd like to read a little bit from O'Brien on the issue of the Christian resentment. Let's see. Yeah. The two currents are Christian resentment and nationalist resentment. Christian resentment drew its strength from the centuries of Christian teaching, as strong in the Lutheran tradition as in the Catholic, which portrayed the Jews as a people uniquely set apart and cursed, the people chosen by God, who had then rejected and crucified his son. Christians blamed the Jews for the dissemination of Enlightenment ideas, for the weakening of Christian faith and power. And they also blamed the Jews as a good way of discrediting Enlightenment ideas that were seen as a threat to them, because these ideas they had seen benefiting the Jews certainly more than they benefited themselves. Christian writers invited people to return to the good old days when all power had been in Christian hands and when the Jews knew their place. The nationalist resentment was that the Jews were an international people in an age of nationalism, and therefore that should not be. The thing was contrary to nature. Jews were really aliens, and consequently any power acquired by Jews was an alienation of national power. That meant that somehow I was the loser. It was something not to be tolerated. The more European nationalisms became excited, as they did from the 1870s following the Franco-Prussian War, the more obsessed they became with the image of the hostile alien and the more racist, therefore, that resentment became. The Christian anti-Semitism had a limit, and that limit was that, the Jew could become a Christian. There was kind of a way out. The Jew could realize the folly of not recognizing Jesus Christ as the Messiah, et cetera, et cetera, and therefore kind of repent for past wrongs. So there was a limit there. And in fact, the Christians really used this idea as a way of vindicating their own ideas. The Jews' existence was further justified by the service they rendered to the Christian truth in attesting through their humiliation the triumph of the church over the synagogue. They were nice folks to have around to kind of show how humiliated and horrible their lives had been because they had not become Christians and therefore made Christians and the Christian church look a little better. People like Augustine said they were unintelligent, but they did possess intelligent books. Thomas Aquinas considered the Jews condemned to perpetual servitude because of their crime, but they were not to be deprived of necessities of life. I mean, you could say all these things about them. They killed Christ, and they were paying for it all these years, but never was it an issue that they should be killed because of that. And in fact, in the canon of the Easter Mass, O'Connor here says, one of the lines goes, O God, who in thy goodness dost not even deny mercy to the perfidious Jews. So there you see, I mean, they had condemned themselves, yet there was still always an out, and there was grace for them. There was forgiveness for them. I guess I wanted to say that so it would just give you kind of an idea of where the average person stood in vis-a-vis the Jews in Western Europe, the Christian resentment and the nationalist resentment. Nobody was talking about genocide. Nobody was talking about killing Jews. But that was the kind of fertile ground upon which a lot of other agendas then were to be played out that, of course, ended up very, very tragically. The nationalist views, of course, were more dangerous. And then when racism was added to the mix, it became potentially genocidal. As I said before, you could change your religion, but how in the world were you going to change your race? That was something that you could not do. Right. Here's a quote from a 19th century German on antisemitism, a man by the name of Pulzer, who said, the vague and irrational image of the Jew as the enemy probably did not change much when the orators stopped talking about Christ slayers and began talking about the laws of blood. The difference lay in the effect achieved. It enabled antisemitism to be more elemental and more uncompromising, and its logical conclusion was to substitute the gas chamber for the pogrom. Again, talk about race, blood, very elementary kinds of things, very uncompromising things, things that could not change. And when you start hating a person for those reasons, then you're in a much more dangerous situation than when you hate them for something that they might be able to change. If you have any questions or comments as we go along, please feel free to jump in. The average man or woman in the street felt this way about Jews for a number of reasons. As I said before, the Jews had become emancipated at this time. They were doing very well in life, day-to-day life. And a lot of people were envious, obviously. They were envious of this minority who had entered into the mainstream of life and were doing quite well. They were obviously just waiting to be scapegoats as a minority. And then there's some other issues here that I found very interesting when I was doing some research, which have to do with the Industrial Revolution. Again, the ideas of the Enlightenment, liberal ideas, they're embraced by many Jews. They destroyed a lot of things that people had held sacred. But the Industrial Revolution now destroyed the author calls the intimate relationship between the worker and the owner. And this comes from a book that I've quoted before, Max Demont, Jews, God and History. Now the foreman and the manager, department manager, stood between the worker and his or her employer. Where before, let's say you'd been a tailor or a carpenter, whatever, you had been intimately involved in the product that you were making. The Industrial Revolution came along, and of course, now there was a machine doing your work. There was a lot more distance between between your effort and what you could see as a result of it. In 1850, the average business employed fewer than 50 people. It was a time when old patterns were changing and people were distressed at the lack of having some of the old, familiar, and comforting ideas to hold on to. As the religious forces holding society together weakened as a result of the Enlightenment, the psychological forces holding people's unconscious hostilities in check were also weakened. The social breakdown brought insecurity, and the psychological breakdown brought anxiety. So here you have a large group of people who are insecure, who are anxious, and you add that to that fact, who see themselves falling down the social ladder. The one group of people who were most affected by this state of affairs is what DeMont calls, it's a very interesting expression, and he calls them the frayed white-collar class. These were the workers of the middle class or the lower middle class who, in a sense, had lost their place. They'd lost their place during the Industrial Revolution. What they had been doing before with pride was now being done by a machine. Before, they had produced products that needed their skilled handiwork, but now machines did their work, and they pushed paper as mid- and lower-level clerks in large, impersonal businesses. They were the frayed white-collar class rather than the real white-collar class, who were the managers and the professionals. It was from this group, people who see themselves sliding down the economic ladder, again, people who are insecure, people who are anxious, it was from this group that Hitler recruited his most ardent followers. They were most affected economically by the changes taking place and as a result became most estranged from former values and status symbols. They became the most insecure and the most anxiety-ridden and looked for leaders who would restore their lost prestige and their former security. Religion used to serve that function, but now there had to be something else to fill that void. Into this mix of people who are anxious, who see their social status diminished, and of course at the same time see this other minority of Jews doing very, very well, and envy and everything else that goes along with it, comes the politicians. The politicians were not particularly anti-Semitic in terms of their ideology, but what they saw was an incredible opportunity to use all of this anxiousness and what have you for their own good. And believe me, they used it. They used it in Austria extremely well. In fact, name I can't remember now, I'm sure Paul knows it, a person who was elected to be, I think, the president of Austria, was one of Hitler's great teachers because he had done exactly the same kind of thing. He had seen, it's like any politician, you know, you see a bunch of disaffected people and there's a lot of power, and so you use that power. But of course, that kind of thing got out of hand. Politicians began to pander to the insecurities of this group because they needed the power that this group of people had. Economic depressions were forcing this frayed white-collar class into the ranks of the working class, who, of course, they despised. They saw themselves going down the social ladder toward the lower class that they despised. They were also fearful of the new philosophies of socialism and communism, which would give power to the same working class they despised. So here they see the Jews above, who they're envious of, and they see the lower class where they're heading, who have these ideas of communism and socialism, which they see as a threat as well. I think we may be able to say that a lot of the politicians and perhaps a lot of the people in this frayed white-collar class may have felt slightly guilty about their anti-Semitic ideas. I mean, after all, these people were not all evil people. They were just normal people like you and I. And while they may have felt a little guilty about it, what they needed then were some experts, quote, experts, to come along and make them not feel so guilty. And here we come to another one of those places in the road. There were people willing and waiting to make them not feel guilty. And history marches on. First they got the philosophy, and then they got the scientists. And I use the term scientist rather loosely, because certainly by the time, well, certainly by the 1920s and even before that, there were there were scientific theories that were far from what you would call legitimately scientific. Most of you know that by certainly the 30s, anybody who was a legitimate physicist or a scientist and also happened to be Jewish were gone. They were gone from Germany. And the most outrageous ideas passed for science. At the University of Göttingen, there was this group of skulls, and people were running around measuring these skulls and making incredible judgments based on these skull measurements, which were supposed to indicate one thing or another. So a lot of the real scientists left Germany because the whole scientific world became so debased, and what was left were just these kind of loony people running around passing themselves off for scientists, and their science was based on these weird racial theories. A couple of the philosophers I thought would be interesting for you to hear about. One was a fellow by the name of Edward Drumont, who was a Frenchman. It's interesting. Anti-Semitism was never as dangerous in France as it was certainly in Germany or Austria, but surprisingly, a lot of the thinkers, the anti-Semitic thinkers, were French. This fellow lived from about 1844 to 1917, and it's interesting to see how many of these anti-Semitic writers, philosophers, what have you, all resemble each other in a few interesting ways. This man is described as a hard-working, respectable, ambitious, but frustrated journalist who believed that his great talents had been blunted and ignored because of forces beyond his control. Read the Jews. And that other frustrated artist by the name of Hitler, who was in Austria thinking that his great talents were also ignored because of forces beyond his control. It's interesting how this same kind of set of characteristic replays itself again and again. I'd like to read you just a bit of what this man wrote. He wrote an anti-Semitic leaflet, or was it a couple volumes, I guess, in 1886. And it's amazing. This publication ran into 121 editions within the first year of its publication, and it was, at that point, the most widely read book in France. He went very far to remove what we talked about before, the Christian limit, because he, like other anti-Semites, had accepted and popularized this ritual murder story. You know, the Jews take Christian babies and kill them and use their blood for making Passover bread, etc. You know, all that awful stuff. Well, he started saying these kinds of things again. But his main theme is that the Jews not merely crucified Christ in the past, but they were continuing to crucify him now, today, even in France. He presents Christ as insulted, torn by thorns, crucified, and he says nothing has changed in 1,800 years. It's the same lie, the same hate, the same people. So we move one step further. Now it's not the fact that they crucified Christ in the past, but the same thing is happening now, right now. So there's no escape. They're still guilty. They're doing the same things again and again. There's another bit here that I think you should hear, which is quite amazing. For the first time in 4,000 years, nearly 4,000 years of Jewish history, an entirely new picture of the Jews arose, that of the Jews as conspirators. In the Middle Ages, the Jew had been depicted as a stupid, uncouth, flea-bitten lout in order to create such an abhorrent image of him that no self-respecting Christian would want to convert to the Jewish faith. In the new catechism of the anti-Semites, the Jew was conceded to have superior intellect, learning, skill, and capacity to excel. But these virtues were now evil, for these were the qualities which the frayed white-collar class realized it did not possess. By making these qualities vices, Drumont made mediocrity a virtue. His book attempted to show how the Jews, with their intellect, learning, and skill, would soon dominate France and turn it into a Jewish state. He had correctly appraised the psychological needs of the declassed, frayed white-collar class. The denigrated Jew of the Middle Ages, the hunchback peddler with the yellow patch, was an outdated medieval symbol. This type of Jew could not be a threat, but the diabolical Jew with superior cunning, this was the enemy, and overnight the symbol created by Drumont became the Bible of the declassed folks. Then you had just incredible ideas, racial ideas, coming from people, a British fellow by the name of Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who lived from about 1855 to 1927. In 1900, he wrote a book that, in this book, he said incredible things. By the way, he was also married to Richard Wagner's daughter, that King David, the prophets, and Jesus were not Jews. They were Germans. And they had to be, because how could anybody like King David, the prophets, and Jesus be anything other? They couldn't be Jews, because this was part of this polluted race, and therefore they were really Germans. And people believed it. They believed it. In 1853, there was another Frenchman by the name of Gobineau. Again, a minor official in the French diplomatic service, he was embittered by never having advanced to a post of important service. Same thing over and over again. He wrote what is called the first systematic presentation of a racist general theory. The publication was called The Inequality of Human Races, and it was this first systematic theory of white racial supremacy. Again, he was not necessarily anti-Semitic. His concept was that there was one single cause behind the fall of all civilization, and that was the dilution of the superior blood in the aristocracy by the inferior blood of the common people. So not only was he a racist, but he was an elitist too. The blood of the Aryan elite had been diluted by the blood of the non-Aryan races through democracy. He does not mention the Jews, but it didn't take long, again, for Germans and others to make the association. He didn't make it, but others made it. And now on to the Superman philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche lived from 1844 to 1900. It's interesting. He went mad in 18, 1798, which was the year that Hitler was born. And it was really Nietzsche who removed the Christian limit to the Christian anti-Semitism, because he literally linked, he hated Christianity more than he hated Judaism or Jews. And he hated that because he thought that this corrupting influence of Christian ideology of compassion, which of course he thought was originally Jewish, and therefore had been forced on the Christian church or on Christians by the Jews. It was everything he hated. It was weak, it was compassion, it was the whole business. So he said, really, the Jews are to blame for this, because in a sense, they have polluted Christianity. It's incredible, but nonetheless true. A little bit of his writings. Let's see. Write with blood, advises Nietzsche, and you learn that spirit is blood. In Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche also laid down the foundation for the morality of his Superman with such maxims as, you I advise not to work but to fight, and you I advise not to peace but to victory, and a man shall be raised, these are some interesting things, a man shall be raised as a warrior, a woman for a warrior's recreation. And are you going to women? Do not forget your whip. His Superman is beyond good and evil, for, says Nietzsche, the falseness of an opinion is for us no objection to it. And we are fundamentally inclined to maintain that the falsest of opinions are the most indispensable to us. His philosophy led indeed to a complete defiance of Christianity, to a complete reversal of the teachings of the Gospel and Decalogue. His works, the cornerstone for the Nazi state, were written during the decade before his insanity, and he died insane. It may be that Nietzsche did not advocate what he wrote, but that he foresaw with the clarity of a prophet the morality of the new age ahead. But we are not passing value judgments on the man. We are concerned with the effects of his philosophy. Nietzsche did not create history, but his books did. There is another bit here that's interesting, Nietzsche. He said that he had a brother-in-law who was anti-Semitic, but that Nietzsche hated this kind of vulgar Christian anti-Semitism that in the end, of course, gave Jews an out, that there was still some grace, compassion. It is also true that the main thrust of Nietzsche's writing was not directed against the Jews, it was directed against Christianity, but the way in which it was directed against Christianity made it far more dangerous to Jews than Christians. Nietzsche's message was that the Christian ethic was poison. Its emphasis on mercy reversed the true Aryan values of fierceness, pride, severity, strength, hatred, revenge, and the people responsible for this transvaluation of values, the root of all the evil, were the Jews, because those were originally Jewish values, which were then co-opted by Christianity, and therefore real Christianity was debased. He wrote in The Antichrist, "One is among Jews. The first consideration to keep from losing the thread completely, Paul and Christ were little superlative Jews. One would no more associate with the first Christians than one would with Polish Jews. They both do not smell good. Pontius Pilate is the only figure in the New Testament who commands respect. To take a Jewish affair seriously, he does not proceed himself to do that. One Jew more or less, what does it matter?" So, that's Nietzsche. We can then ask, where was the church? It's an incredible story to read, and it's not an easy one to read. But you have to, and here I have to read this article that, or from this article that was lately published in the New York Review of Books by, again, by Connor Cruz O'Brien, where he talks about this whole issue of German nationalism, which then comes into play. The at that point there was this, you know, this distancing from God, and the delegitimizing of the monarchy. It left, he says, an emotional vacuum which many people found intolerable. The gap was filled by the cult of what became the nation. You've all heard that term, the German folk, the German nation. The nation exists before all. It is the origin of everything. It is the law itself. And in a sense, the nation has really become God. And that is literally the doctrine of the Third Reich, of the German folk, the German nation. How did this come about? O'Brien says it was the product of a, well, first of all, the German nationalism was a particularly militant nationalism, and it was also a product of tremendous ups and downs in modern German history. There was tremendous triumph, of course, the victory over France and the national unification of Germany, but within 50 years, there was total humiliation in World War I. And who did Hitler blame? In 1918 and 1919, there was the famous phrase we've all heard, the stab in the back. It was the Jews. The Jews had brought this upon us. And the Jews had not only stabbed us in the back, but the Jews were, in fact, keeping Germany from rising again. So you had all of this stuff. You had the racist theory, the philosophy, the politicians who took advantage of a bad situation, and then you add to that a mixture of national humiliation, and then along with it, of course, goes the economic problems of the worldwide depression that came, and what you then have is a recipe for genocide. And that is very well posited by a man named Alfred Rosenberg, who was a Nazi. And in 1930, he wrote something entitled The Myth of the 20th Century. Germany, he said, after the defeat in World War I and the humiliation, etc., should be rebuilt not on Christian principles, there's Nietzsche again, but on the philosophy of Nietzsche, should be a state of supermen, a state without principles. Christianity was a Jewish disease. Forget such Christian principles as guilt, sin, morality. Instead, they devised a new Christianity from which St. Paul was purged. And Jesus was made into a Nordic. He was given a Syrian mother and a Roman father, both pure pagans. A new myth was born, the myth of the mystique of Aryan blood. And the worst thing about it is that the church bought it. They bought all of it. Maybe not all of it, but a good deal of it. And a lot of very famous theologians bought it too. A lot of famous Lutheran theologians. I was reading through here. Interesting, he says, less than 50 years after the spectacular triumph in Germany came the less spectacular humiliation, the total military defeat at the end of the bloodiest war in history up to that date. It is at that nullpunkt of 1918 that the political career of Adolf Hitler as a preacher of hatred and revenge began. And what sustained him and carried him to the top was the hate-filled and vengeful nationalism of the Germans. Jews were identified as a people who had pretended to be part of the state and then stabbed the state in the back, and in this way the seeds of destruction of Jews in Europe was shown. The clearest illustration of the power of nationalism in legitimizing the rise of power of the Nazis and then their actions consists of the language and actions of the Christian churches in Germany at that time. Followers of Jesus Christ might perhaps have been expected to manifest some disapproval of the greatest preacher and practitioner of hatred and revenge that ever walked the earth, but the Christian churches, with the exception of a few brave individuals, manifested no disapproval of Hitler and National Socialism. On the contrary, in statement after statement, they hailed Adolf Hitler as the savior of the nation. The reason was that the churches were so saturated in German nationalism themselves, as their statement showed, that they were incapable of offering any resistance to National Socialism, which was a particularly militant manifestation of German nationalism. The infestation, it is nothing less, of German Christianity by German nationalism is most clearly seen in the Lutheran and evangelical churches, who were more German than the German Catholics could allow themselves to be, at least in their doctrinal statements. And then he quotes some incredible, incredible things from Gerhard Kittel, who said, "We must not now allow ourselves to be crippled because the whole world screams at us of barbarism and a reversion to the past. How the German state regulates its own cultural affairs does not concern anyone else in the world. Justice is not an abstraction, but something which grows out of the blood and soil and history of the German state." Paul Althaus said, "In this knowledge, we as believing Christians thank God, our Father, that he has given to our state in its time of need the Führer as a pious and faithful sovereign, and that he wants to prepare for us in the national socialist system of government good rule, a government with new inner discipline and honor. As a creation of God, the state is the law of our life." And that's where the church was. Everybody was silent up to a certain point. Of course, people could speak, but after a point, they couldn't. Hitler became Chancellor of Germany in 1933. 1936, the Nuremberg Laws would strip Jews of their citizenship. 1938, Kristallnacht, when bands of thugs, brown shirts, went up and down the streets, smashing the shop windows of Jews. People stood by, didn't say anything. And 1942 was the Wannsee Conference, where the final solution to the Jewish question was discussed. Of course, we remember the famous quote of Martin Niemöller. When they came for the trade unionists, I wasn't a trade unionist. I didn't say anything. They came for the communists, I wasn't a communist. They came for the Jews, I wasn't a Jew. And they came for me, and there was nobody left. You wonder how normal people act, so-called normal people act, in normal times. I was reading this DeMont book, and I came to a part which I just simply couldn't believe, and I want to read it to you because I guess it speaks something to me as a bureaucrat. You know, I write business letters and I write memos and kind of push paper from one side of the desk to the other. I hope I do other things than that. But this is a part of a letter, business letter, that was written from the director of the DDA Works in Berlin. And it gives you some idea of the kinds of things that were discussed in business letters, of what all of this added up to. The letter says, "For placing the bodies into the furnaces, we suggest simply a metal tray moving on cylinders. Each furnace will have an oven measuring only 24 by 18 inches, as coffins will not be used. For transporting corpses from the storage points, the gas chambers, to the furnaces, we suggest using light carts on wheels, and we enclose diagrams of these drawn to scale." I guess that's the end of of all of this. I always think it's important. I hear a lot of people say, how did this happen? It's like a big thing we can't understand. How could this have happened? Well, this is how it happened. You can figure it out. It's not difficult. We're not dealing with one of the great conundrums of history here. It's all down. You can follow it step by step. And I think if there's any lesson to be learned about this, it's simply, I mean, we don't have to talk about Germans. We can talk about any number of people. That in the right set of circumstances, people will believe outrageous things, and on the basis of those outrageous beliefs, they will commit monstrous crimes. And it can happen to anybody. I think about this a lot, and I watch the news, and I see what's going on in the world, and I'm not a prophet. But the one thing that does frighten me is a situation where there would be major economic catastrophe in this country. For example, you know, another depression or a collapse of the currency or whatever. And if that ever happens, which will of course be a situation which will affect vast numbers of middle class people who will then see themselves losing everything that they have worked so hard for. That is the time that we had better, if it happens, run to guard our minority populations, be they homosexuals, be they Jews, be they blacks, Southeast Asian refugees, be they Spanish-speaking minorities, because that is the very, very dangerous time. I don't know if that's going to happen, but anyway, I think about it. The last thing that that I'd like to say is Connor Cruz O'Brien, in writing this great article, brings all of this kind of into our lives when he says, and he says it much better than I could ever say it. In conclusion, I should like to stress that all of us who are concerned with the potential for hatred on our societies should keep a wary eye on nationalism, and in particular, be watchful for signs of increasing hubris in nationalism anywhere. Some of us think we have seen a few such signs in American nationalism during the past decade, and most conspicuously during the recent presidential election campaign. Like many others, I did not at all like the combination in that campaign of strident displays of nationalism in the so-called issue of the pledge to the flag, with subliminal appeals to racist feelings, the Willie Horton case. That combination of nationalism and racism has a little taste of the old, heady, Volkisch cocktail, has it not? Please don't mistake my intention here. I am not trying to assimilate George Bush to Adolf Hitler. What I am suggesting, and I think here he is absolutely right, is that Bush, like the political expedient folks, you know, they weren't bad people. They just saw a good political thing. And they were short-sighted enough to not understand that they were playing with fire. What I'm suggesting is that Bush, during the campaign and for limited electoral purposes, flirted with those same dark forces which in another land and in very different circumstances brought Adolf Hitler to power. I think that when we see any powerful person start such a flirtation, we have a right and a duty to call on them by whatever means are available us to break it off. For if such a flirtation should ever develop into something more permanent, a dangerous liaison, and the most dangerous of all liaisons, then it might be too late to call a halt to the resurgence of hatred and persecution.
Well, Germany was a different country than this country. This country has existed far much longer than Germany has. See, Germany got together about
71.
Most of the people thought of themselves as Bavarians or Hanoverians or Swedish people. They weren't, they had no, this German nationalism, the people up north, the Kaiser promoted a lot of it. The Baron Chancellor did too, to bring them together, to make a country out of them. That's been the old promotion for an awful long time. It just didn't start with Hitler.
It was a, as I said, it was a particular kind of militaristic nationalism that perhaps we don't see right now. But again, if you put that kind of the cocktail together, let's say there is not only economic, terrible economic hardship, but also national humiliation. I mean, right now we're talking about an amendment to the Constitution so that the flag can't be burned. I mean, I don't know what that means. I've been thinking about that for the last few days. Again, you know, you don't want to cry wolf all the time. But again, I think the lesson here is that when you have a convergence of historical circumstances, you have to be a little careful. And I especially think what O'Connor says at the end, the manipulation of these dark forces that I think lie under the surface of any different country or a cultural group can be played for tragedy. And again, it's not by bad people. It's not by the evil guys. It's by people who, you know, mean pretty well. But sometimes I guess they don't realize what they're potentially playing with. Yeah.
Tying into your comment about Bush, somebody wants to take some time and look at the upstairs in the library is a magazine I hold in the subscription called The Black Scholar. Mm. In the latest issue, talks about looking at racism throughout the American election system. And there's an article in there that not talked about the last election, but the way that nice terms such as different terms that don't sound racist are actually hiding racist type possibilities. It would be really worth people's time to look at.
It's that incredible mix of nationalism and racism. Of course, then when the moral people, the ones who are supposed to put on the brakes, when they're co-opted into the whole situation, then the devil is loose.
Well, such terms like law and order, such terms as soft on crime. Think behind those terms, what lies in this country? Who do we in our general images think those people are that we're trying to protect ourselves from? And like you mentioned about the, in quotes, minorities coming out of ballpark, those are the majority of people that come to people's mind. And William Horton example. I'm just saying, we have, the way that politicians use that, I'm just reaffirming that, is very, just goes on here all the time, in almost every political election there is, for expediency. But the roots are there.
Carol, you said nothing about Martin Luther's role. There are some, including Scheibler, who believe that Luther's religious, Luther's writings against the Jews in his later life on a religious basis, not I think a nationalist basis, but a religious basis, fed some of the German feeling against the Jews in the 20th century, and at least they were quoted by leaders, including Hitler. Do your sources support that?
Well, they don't Luther is never really mentioned. I think that Luther is seen more of kind of, I mean, it's certainly not excusing him, but again, he was kind of in this traditional Christian limit group.
Right.
He didn't want to kill the Jews.
No.
But he just want, you know, they're frustrated him like
but
crazy.
But he did say it serves them right.
It serves them right.
Abused.
Right.
And,
they can be abused
and
oppressed.
And oppressed. They don't accept
Christ. Right. Because you see,
he was
see,
angry. He was very angry.
See you people. This is what happens to people who don't believe in that Jesus Christ is Messiah. This is what happens to them. But I don't believe. I'm not an expert on Luther, but I don't believe he ever said that they should be killed. So he's up there with the rest of these guys. It takes it takes us getting further down.
But some of the others later were able to use what?
Oh, of course they used. They used.
Shiner in the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich makes quite a bit of
great extent. Of course, I mean he was quoted, and those words were used to. I guess we're finished, folks. It's about